the necessity and the ethical importance of supporting adaptation in the least emission-creating, most vulnerable places, that's a part that I think is really being taken off the table in a way that the future is not going to be kind to the history that's being created now.
Welcome to Development Dialogues, a podcast series bringing together experts from research and policy to answer questions that are key to addressing today's most complex global development challenges. We'll discuss how the latest research in development economics can inform strategies to fight poverty, reduce inequality, and drive inclusive economic growth. Development Dialogues is a collaboration between Yale's Economic Growth Center and VoxDev. Hello, and welcome to Development Dialogues. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. In this episode, we're tackling a critical and complex question. How can the global clean energy transition advance quickly and equitably, especially for low and middle income countries still working to reduce poverty? While all countries must reduce emissions, the burden is not evenly shared. Many of the world's poorest nations didn't cause the climate crisis, and yet they're under growing pressure to act. Our guests today bring sharp insights into how low and middle income countries can navigate the complex intersection of climate mitigation and development. We're joined by Max Birak, a reporter for The New York Times who covers international climate negotiations, energy politics, and new approaches to reducing emissions. His recent Poynter lecture at Yale asked, "Why are the rich failing the poor on climate change?" Anant Sudarshan is an economist at the University of Warwick and a senior fellow at the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. His work focuses on environmental regulation and air pollution, and he's the senior editor of an upcoming VoxDev Lit on that very topic. And Jessica Seddon is a governance and environmental policy expert whose career spans India and the US. She focuses on how institutions can better use data to tackle challenges like air quality and climate risk. She's currently a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson School of Global Affairs, director of the Dietz Family Initiative on Environment and Global Affairs, and faculty affiliate of Yale's Economic Growth Center. We'll explore how shifting climate policies in the US and China, the world's top two emitters, are shaping the global energy transition, why air pollution might offer a practical starting point for climate action, and how local institutions can take greater control of their climate futures. Max, Anant, Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you. Thanks, Catherine.
I want to start by digging into this core tension that many low and middle income countries are grappling with. It's this trade-off, as it's sometimes described, between poverty reduction and climate mitigation. So, of course, we know it's critical for every country to reduce emissions, but when countries that didn't cause the climate crisis are being asked to make these major changes, that may not be fair. It may not be realistic. Do you acknowledge that that's a tension? And given that tension, what can be done?
I certainly acknowledge it's a tension. I mean, it's the central tension, it seems, at least if you listen to the discourse at climate negotiations. Who is responsible? Who pays? Can we call it reparations? How quick can this transition go? All of those kinds of questions. What I'd like to get into a lot in this conversation is how the conversation seems to revolve around money and how much money is owed or is needed. But a lot of that conversation seems to think that money is a way of fixing this or solving this crisis when it doesn't really address some of the kind of fundamental causes of it, which come from a certain kind of economic system that we all live in now.
My initial instinct is that I don't think that's the framing that I would use. I think climate change is a global public goods problem. And it's not about asking developing countries to do something or not do something in that the United States may say whatever it wants. That doesn't make India take action or not make India take action. But the costs of climate change will occur in any case. So I think framing this issue in the sort of us versus them, is this reparations, whose fault it is entirely counterproductive. I think when it is framed like that by developing countries, it is often instrumental. It is in much the same way as the United States does not want to take action sometimes and has reasons for it. When India does not wish to take action, this is one of the reasons that they use. But I just don't think it's that kind of problem. The costs of climate change are incident in large amounts on India and China. So it really doesn't matter what they are asked to do or not asked to do. It's in their interests to have the world solve this problem or address this problem.
I think there are two issues that are being intertwined in here. The first is that this transition is not necessarily doing unappealing new things. This is essentially the need for the long term to bring down the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, as well as warming aerosols, is something that requires us to try out new ways of producing energy and new food systems, for that matter, faster than what otherwise have happened by retiring the old ways and building new ways. And that the cost of that speed is leaving investments to not fully be paid back. It means leaving fossil fuels that have been identified in the ground rather than sold. And it means figuring out how to deal with new kinds of project risks, accelerating the development of new technologies. So it's faster, which is costly, but it's not a dead end to nowhere. These changes would happen. And in many ways, the leaders in those who make these changes faster in terms of battery technology, solar technologies, different ways of dealing with wind, are going to have an economic advantage in the future. I think it's important to keep an eye on that and how do current actions by the US or current multilateral actions affect the potential for that gain and affect the potential for that speed if the resources to pay for that speed are not forthcoming and have never really been forthcoming. So I think looking at it as a speed question brings up other dimensions. The second point is, I think, the tension between mitigation and adaptation. The climate impacts and dealing with the impacts over the next couple of decades is an adaptation question much more than mitigation, just given the way that energy imbalance plays out. The necessity and the ethical importance of supporting adaptation in the least emission-creating, most vulnerable places, that's a part that I think is really being taken off the table in a way that the future is not going to be kind to the history that's being created now.
I totally hear what you were saying, Anant, that this us versus them can be counterproductive. And yet there are dynamics where aid, for example, has been used as a tool. And from the perspective of some of these countries, quote unquote, dirty power sources might be the preferred path to green technologies. Can you speak to aid in this context when it comes to countries and how they navigate poverty reduction and climate mitigation?
Look, I mean, in this context, aid as it pertains to climate and energy is typically aid that is going towards places with very little energy now. The U.S.-India relationship, I'd love to hear Anant talk about it a bit more, but is not fundamentally predicated on that type of exchange. Whereas the U.S., through USAID and also through multilateral development banks that it essentially controls, is or was, in some cases, channeling a lot of money towards what previous administrations hoped for was a lot of growth in things like solar mini grids and solar home systems in Africa, mostly. And a lot of that was predicated on the belief that it was not only getting so much cheaper to deploy that kind of energy, but that you could do it really quickly and that it would place less burden on really old grids in these countries that it would cost a lot of money to expand or renovate. Now, whether any of that is actually going to happen, all of these huge pledges of spending tens of billions of dollars on that is still yet to be seen. I think much more important of a dynamic than that kind of aid space is the role of China and Chinese companies and the way that governments across the developing world are choosing to engage in those large-scale projects and contracts.
I just want to flag that aid is part of the acceleration of different forms of infrastructure that are both more resilient and lower emission. But another big piece of it is also trade. And I think what's happening right now with the tariff volatility is also having a pretty significant impact on the ability of low and middle income countries to develop their own EV, renewable energy, battery technologies and markets. If you look, for example, at the impact of the U.S. tariffs on the EV industry in Nuevo León in Mexico, I mean, it's completely disrupted the formation of the kind of infrastructure and technologies that are needed. And that impact of tariffs, I hope, remains front and center as another damaging consequence.
Just on aid and what developing countries are doing, I think the first thing that we should remember is that, for example, practically all new grid capacity is renewable capacity today. That's the case in China. Certainly, it's the case in India. This is now the cheapest source of power. So when we think about what are these developing countries going to do, well, if you want them to retire the coal plants they already have, then you might need to pay them for it. But the cheapest form of power at the margins now is renewable electricity. And India has said China is installing hundreds of gigawatts of power of solar capacity. India had a 500 gigawatt by 2030 target, which they will likely meet. So the only constraint on meeting those targets is the economic growth of these countries themselves. So if aid has a role to play, I think there's two things here. If money is not flowing towards mitigation in terms of buying out and retiring existing fossil fuel capacity, that's to me just another manifestation of the relative unwillingness to take expensive climate action in countries like the United States. And it has nothing to do with it being in India, because they're not taking that action domestically either, right? So it's where you spend the money comes after you decide to spend the money. So it is really climate adaptation where the rubber hits the road, because we are going to have climate change. We already have climate change, and it's going to be very costly. So if we want to think about a sort of us or them relationship or an aid relationship, it comes down to where is the money for adaptation going to come from? And that is a capital need, but it is not about mitigation. It's about crops that are resistant to increasing temperature, heat deaths. Those impacts are quite bad in South Asia as well, although South Asia is, as Max pointed out, or at least India, is not a major recipient of sort of development aid in that sense. But it could certainly use the money for climate adaptation.
I'd be really curious to know where you think that money for adaptation can come from. It's such a huge question. And there are, of course, the formation of various funds here and there that we hear about, $10 million, $30 million here and there coming from a Denmark or what have you. But we need so much more than that.
Yeah, so I was interestingly at a conference organized by the Indian Statistical Institute in Delhi with a number of people from the Indian government, and exactly the same question came up. And I think it was the chief economic advisor who said, or one of the economic advisors, that they don't really see it as being very likely that this capital will come from the West, because there's been no sign of this type of fund transfer. And so India is attempting to raise that money. A small portion of it will come from domestic funds. Another portion of it might come from increased corporate taxes or CSR spending. That's not going to meet what we expect to need by a long way. And so you're going to see costs imposed on people. So I did not get the sense, and I do not have any reason to think, that there is a lot of belief that there will be capital flowing from the United States to India to solve these problems. And in part because it runs into the thorny issue that it starts looking a lot like conventional aid. And that's not something that necessarily these countries want to be asking for with that label on it. So it is a problem that we need creative solutions for. And for example, it is possible that India sets up a carbon market that, if it could integrate with the EU ETS, say, would be able to use mitigation as a means of sort of pushing some capital in, but then the use of that capital is largely to enable greater adaptation. But I don't think there's a good solution to that, and that it's going to mean very heavy costs on these developing countries.
I would second that there's a core of really concessional to grant public funding that's going to be necessary for adaptation. And there's no painting that away. However, there are two other areas where I think that the extent of capital needed could be reduced. The first is that the costs of adaptation and the calculations of the costs of adaptation really depend on underlying degree of flexibility. So how much can businesses and people move away from coastlines into different sectors? How much can people move even across national boundaries? Esteban Rossi Hansberg has done some work on this and really shown that the friction and the extent of friction in moving spatially and moving sectorally plays a huge role in what the costs of climate change are. So investments in education, in adult skilling, in property rights, in being in property markets, in access to capital, and all of the things that are good for economic flexibility are also investments in adaptation. So there's kind of a dual benefit there that sometimes isn't counted. Part two is that there is, I mean, the same way with mitigation, anyone who develops technologies, modes of infrastructure that are better for a hotter, wetter, drier, different climate is going to have a market beyond what they need. And that is the leadership of the future. And that impulse means that there is some space for private capital to come in, particularly if you look at some of the efforts that are going on within the World Bank Group that will survive whatever the U.S. does, to have the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency play a larger role in using its guarantee facilities, some of the creativity that's going into financial structuring. It's not making up for the lack of concessional support, but it is something. And I think it's important.
I want to pose the same question back to you, Max, when you ask, where's the money going to come from? Because I know a big emphasis of your Poynter lecture was the need not just for more climate finance, but a rethinking of how we value nature and structure our economies. And you gave some examples of how that's starting to happen. So can you expand on that?
I don't want to downplay the notion that we need more money. I think fundamental to what I'm saying is that we need a lot more money than is even being asked for in, say, climate negotiations. And that money is going to need to come from some of the biggest sources of money that we have, these huge asset managers, sovereign wealth funds, private equity firms. But it's also about big sectors like the insurance sector, reinsurance sector, and others changing the way that they value companies, taking climate and natural risk into account in making all sorts of investment. It's firstly not done on a large scale now, but you know, there are some like Norway's sovereign wealth fund and some firms like Morgan Stanley and BlackRock that are looking at incorporating this much more into their valuations. And that they're doing this because they're the ones who are seeing the impacts of climate change and natural risk in the balance sheets of the companies that they invest in. And so they're not trying to make new rules because they care about climate change or adaptation or mitigation, but because climate change is starting to actually diminish the value of many of the companies that they're invested in. And so I think that there is some kind of shimmer of light there in changing the way that money flows to try and bolster entities of different kinds. It could be a forest itself or some kind of energy project as well that have knock-on effects in strengthening the power of ecosystems and nature's services, that those services help companies and communities and countries have economic resilience.
Anant or Jessica, I'd be curious for your views on the role of development economics and the role of economists in helping to expand our definition of economic growth to account for these costs in terms of climate change.
I think there are sort of two strands here. I mean, one is natural capital accounting, which is Eli Fenichel here at Yale has done a lot of work on in the US. I know that India has a working group, Partha Dasgupta in the UK, Stiglitz and Fatusi. There's been a number of different emphasis on the need in national accounts to account for natural capital, and the methodologies on that are becoming more standardized, more adopted, and there's support facilities at the World Bank for doing that. That's one level and recognizing it as an asset. And I think part of what Max is talking about, though, is more on a project level in valuing ecosystem services and nature-based solutions, whether you're valuing them for cleaning the water, cleaning the air, capturing carbon, the role of nature in achieving these things. And one of the bright spots there is actually almost like the competition and the investability of metrics companies. So it's not just an NGO thing anymore. It's actually a venture capital-backed race between different efforts to use combinations of sensing, satellites, AI to be able to detect and track the benefits. There's a lot of scientific validation that needs to happen before some become the standards. But I'm really encouraged by the level of interest in nature metrics as a service and the level of market-driven investment into that. I think it speaks to a future that is closer and probably very constructive. The last thing I'll say is, in the World Economic Forum's risk report this year, I noticed that both nature risk and climate risk had moved into a slot of near-term high-impact risks, which I think speaks to the urgency and the level of interest in figuring out services and provision of services in tracking ecosystem health. Whether it'll be fast enough, different question, but at least it's getting faster.
I agree with most of everything Jessica said. I think there is still in many countries the view that you're trading off growth goals versus environmental goals. It's increasingly obvious that at least on the margins, that's not always true. Air pollution levels, groundwater depletion, these are environmental disasters with massive growth costs. And these are not climate costs necessarily. Some of them are climate co-benefits, but burning coal and air pollution from coal is a cost on India today, now, and that you need make no reference to climate change or any kind of sort of shared responsibility. But we still, I think, have not got to the point where these externalities are being properly accounted for. And whether it's a conventional textbook externality like air pollution or sort of what is the cost of losing biodiversity, some of them are easier to quantify, some of them are not. But across the board, I have found, at least in my work, that we have environment departments that sit in a separate silo drawing up these irritating rules that are in no way integrated into project planning otherwise. And so they just end up looking like burdens, right? So you would think air pollution is a health problem, and so it should be integrated into health policy, but no, it's not. There'll be separate department writing down some rules and nobody else is part of it. So I think there are these governance regulatory issues that I am not an expert on solving, but I think are holding back broadly the effort that Max laid out as being needed.
One of the roles you had asked about development and development economics is in actually translating some of the value of nature, of clean air, of clean water into financial language that can be easily digested by finance ministers, infrastructure line ministries, urban planning, et cetera. The one cautionary note on that translation is that I think it's incredibly important for economists and social scientists. I say this as an economist, to be very, very humble about the latest scientific results, and in representing, not underrepresent or undercount. One of the critiques, for example, of some of the climate modeling on how much to invest now versus grow and then wait for climate damaging, the DICE model, again, coming from Yale, is that it severely underrepresented the science on known impacts because it wasn't easily representable in economics terms. I think that's an incredibly important thing to avoid this time around. So making sure that whatever metrics, whatever language, whatever accounting standards are continuously updated in consultation with scientists is absolutely essential to keep up with the changes.
Anant, I know that you're senior editor of this upcoming Vox Dev Lit on air pollution. As you mentioned, air pollution has very clear impacts today. There are some climate impacts that are further off that we can't feel today. But anything more to say about what's happening in the air pollution space that may offer lessons for broader climate action?
My diagnosis of part of the problem is that it is a state capacity problem, in that if the government or if politicians think they cannot solve a problem reasonably, then there is a tendency to ignore it. And if you look at air pollution in India, you have a set of regulatory instruments. There are many laws on the books. There are many rules on paper, and they're not working. And so the challenge for someone saying, okay, you need to pay more attention to air pollution, is to also help the state figure out what they're supposed to do that is going to work. What are the policy levers that are going to actually work, because the existing levers are not doing so. And so some of my research is in that area, but I think that is a very important part of this, because there's a certain defensiveness that creeps in when you're constantly told about how bad a problem is. and you don't think the state machinery is able to deal with it. There remains a sort of cognitive dissonance, if you like, in the way this is talked about. There was a question in the Indian Parliament, this comes up every year, but there was one last winter about what are the health costs of air pollution? And the answer was there are nothing, no certain known health costs of air pollution in the Indian context. So you have an environment ministry with rules, but you're not willing to acknowledge the basis of those rules, because if you do that, then the failure to adhere to those rules becomes more important. If you're going to have standards that are violated, it's sort of easier to deal with that if you don't keep bringing up what that violation means in real terms. So there is that cognitive dissonance, but I think there is a state capacity problem. And it's an interesting research area on how you make states more effective at solving these problems.
Air quality in India is an infrastructure issue. So what is the state capacity to regularly and quickly update public transport infrastructure is a core question for state capacity. So it's not as much as an adoption of new technologies as an overhaul of the ability to deliver complex projects at different scales faster, which is to say that there's not really an easy solution on it until some of the environmental change, whether it's air quality or mitigation, gets reclassified as a matter of district economic development, of human capital development, as something that would traditionally be seen as an, oh, right, we're going to develop the Golden Quadrilateral or the North, South, East, West corridor in the name of an economic development goal. It needs to almost get slotted into different channels and then capacity upgrade.
I do want to return to China. Our central question here is, who really holds the power in the global clean energy transition? And this is an interesting moment for China.
I'm not sure that I would use the word power or say like that China holds the power per se. China has a very powerful command economy that can, in a way that almost no other, develop rapidly an entire industry and come to dominate it, especially if it's a nascent one, like a lot of renewable energy technology is. And I don't mean to say that it's all brand new. This stuff has been in development for many years, but the building of it at scale is. And so the fact that China has come to absolutely dominate the production and in many cases also the processing of the raw materials that go into panels and turbines and batteries and so on, does give them immense importance. Now, does it give them control or power? I think that that's more a reflection of the fact that other large economies, whether it's the US or European ones or India for that matter, have had their own setbacks or decision-making, policy-making that has turned them away from doing what China did. Or perhaps they're now trying to make that shift as India is or as Germany is, but they're doing it at a later stage and are up against solar panels, let's say, that China is producing at a very high quality and low cost that have driven the cost of a unit of energy from them so low that this has become, as Anant said, the main way that grid energy is being added around the world. So I guess my main point there is just that I'm not sure that I would assign China a great deal of power. And that may just be a semantic distinction, because of course their importance is paramount in this.
So I'll phrase it a little bit differently. Certainly China plays a significant role in the green energy transitions of other countries as well. And that's sometimes described as a potential partner, but also a potential source of dependence. So there's a complex relationship there.
If you look at the characteristics of the low carbon energy economy and you say, okay, where are the choke points and how long can those last without being competed away by somebody coming up with another alternative? China does have an advantage in being a producer of low cost, high quality solar panels. And to the extent that there's an implicit or an explicit carbon tax, or you have fossil fuel volatility that means that people are looking for some other energy source, both could push toward it. There's a temporary market power, but that can also be competed away over time. Rare earths, for example, are also seen as something that is geopolitically very restricted, but detection and mining technology can change the effective distribution of rare earth access, processing capacity. China has an advantage, but it's not a forever advantage. So I think the nature of power, and maybe this is what you were saying, Max, is much more ephemeral and temporary because there are more options for being able to capture types of energy that are essentially present in a much more widely, evenly distributed way than concentrated fossil fuel deposits. So the whole game is really about how do you capture and move those around? And that is a much more higher frequency competitive game than extraction of fossil fuels. So I guess power is longer than political timescales, but it is temporary.
I guess the way I think about it is that in the first instance, other countries are fortunate to have China manufacturing solar in particular panels at such a low cost. That butts against the fact that even countries like India, like the United States, they don't want to be importing solar panels, even if they're cheaper than anything they make. So India now has a local content requirement, which is going to raise energy costs a little bit. I'm personally skeptical as to whether it'll actually move any manufacturing, but it'll raise energy costs. And the United States is going to have variants of the same type of policy. But I think power has negative connotations. So we are lucky enough to have a very efficient manufacturer of solar panels. And if we want to take climate change seriously as an existential issue, and even if we just want to say that energy has huge returns for countries, then it makes sense to import that capital as cheaply as possible and use that energy to run AI data centers or whatever else you may wish to do. So I find this concern about China's dominance in upstream solar energy technologies a little ill-formed. I think most of the benefits of energy are value-added benefits that come further down the line. So buy the solar panel as cheaply as possible, get it installed now, and then use that electricity. It's not like importing oil. Once you have the solar panels, you have the solar panels and they last for a long time. And so I don't think it makes sense for countries like India, at least, to be putting in local content requirements and generally getting in the way of the energy they can bring on board.
Max, I know that you cover the COP process very closely. I know we've just talked about power, but I do want to talk about agency and the agency of low and middle income countries in this process, especially at this time where wealthier nations are changing their stance on climate action. What does meaningful participation of low income countries look like, not just in day-to-day climate action, but in the formal negotiations on what's next?
My criticism of the COP process is less that developing countries don't have a voice there because they're in the room. And actually, in a lot of cases, the loudest voices at a COP are coming from those countries. How many forums in the world do you have where the Marshall Islands is actually somebody who we're listening to, who I'm quoting at every COP? That's actually really, really unusual. But does COP have any power? Or is it the signaling mechanism that we make it out to be? I think that's where my criticism comes from of the process. Just the sheer fact that since the first COP, over the 30 years that have passed since the first COP, that in those 30 years, half of all human-generated greenhouse gas emissions have taken place is just a stark reminder that this negotiation era, this much more aware era that climate change is an issue and is a real thing and is going to affect everybody and costs bajillions of dollars, has taken place while we have exacerbated the issue to the nth degree. In other words, COP doesn't move anywhere near as fast as it needs to. It is the Galapagos tortoise of climate action. The reason that I before was bringing up these big wealth asset managers as a different place to look is because they do act quicker and we need quick action. And I think the reason we're talking about China too is because they've been able to muster an entire industry in an incredibly short amount of time. And that is the kind of be-all, end-all of all this climate discussion is the ever-increasing urgency.
I think the path to progress is going to be through new, smaller regional alliances that may not be just about emissions that contribute to changes in temperature and precipitation, but also about connected ecological systems, shared ecosystem services, adaptation, widening the options for resilience. And from that, we may end up with a new and more appropriate environmental regime. Right now, we're in this space that the foreseeable damage from environmental change, both climate, ecological, the whole spectrum, plus adding in pollution, is very much within the financial timeframe for long-term asset managers. I mean, if you're thinking about a pension fund that's looking at, you know, payouts in 30 years, 40 years, because you're dealing with, say, teachers as they retire, you have an interest in how the world is 40 years from now. And that requires action, maybe not global, but it requires a combination of management and emission reduction that may be easier to get started in small clubs that may eventually federate back up to something else. And I hope that happens quickly, but I think that's probably a more promising path than full consensus-based multilateral around globally well-mixed gases.
Jessica, I love what you just said about the path to progress. And I do want to end our conversation there. When we talk about a more just and a more effective global clean energy transition and at a faster pace, what's one shift you'd like to see?
Like to see, I don't know whether we will see it. I think that it is on the high energy using individuals to do what they can in their personal and political lives to create more carbon room, to create a little more space for that transition to happen. I think the limited energy access and the level of continued energy poverty are reprehensible, and that we need to create space for that to be solved as an extremely high priority.
Even just, say, a country like the United States looking solely inward and completing a clean energy transition itself buys a whole lot of time for developing countries who use very little power anyway to add on. It will be mostly solar anyway on the margins, and it allows them time to use their assets and not leave them as stranded assets, the coal plants that they already have. The gift of time is one that is in the power of Europe and the US to grant, and it requires doing a transition themselves internally. If I were to be provocative, even Europe, you hear a different sort of discourse from Europe. But if you look at, for example, Germany turning on coal plants when it gets into the midst of a war, I mean, there are all sorts of priorities that are driving energy mix choices in Europe and the United States that are taking us away from this. So I would say just resolve your own energy policy, align it up with these climate goals, and that's a huge thing in itself.
I think that you're not going to get that shift in policy without a kind of deeper philosophical shift, essentially, which is something that feels farther away and more impossible because power has been built through the exploitation of these resources and also comes from the same fount as colonialism did in many ways, belief that man can conquer nature and conquer the world and control it. That needs to be seen as an aberration. And from that point, then you might see more appropriate policy decisions being made. But right now, you know, I think there's a lot of like, how can we not change our way of life or our way of seeing economic models and yet somehow get a different result out of it?
Maybe science education would help. If you just look at the futures, I don't know how old your kids are, but mine will be 92 in 2100. It is hard to think that it's okay to do what we're doing now when you think about it that way. And that stark realization to just calculate how old are your kids in 2100, it's almost making me cry right there. And if I think more people did that calculation, we'd see some change one form or another.
I can't think of a more powerful way to close. So Max, Anant, Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks very much for setting up the conversation.
Thank you for the invitation, Catherine.
Thanks, Catherine. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's all for this episode of Development Dialogues. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit egc.yale.edu, where you can sign up for the EGC newsletter. And if you'd like to learn more about VoxDev, head to voxdev.org, where you can sign up for the VoxDev newsletter to receive a weekly summary of the latest economic research. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider sharing it and leaving a rating and review. And look for the next installment of Development Dialogues wherever you get your podcasts.